When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
To another BritFlix.com podcast. My name is Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Andrea Gibb, an award-winning Scottish screenwriter who was nominated for the BAFTA Carl Foreman Award for a debut feature film, Afterlife, and for a BAFTA Television Award for Elizabeth Missing in 2020. The feature film Dear Frankie and Afterlife won the Scottish Filmmaker of the Year Award and the Women in Film and Television Script Award 2005. Her adaptation of Arthur Ransom's classic children novel, Swallows and Amazons, won the Grand Jury Prize at New York Children Film Festival and a Family Film Award at the Seattle Film Festival. Her adaptation of Andrew O'Hagan's best-selling novel, Mayflies, reduced my whole family to tears when it aired Christmas 2022 and won the BAFTA Scotland Award for Best Scripted Television in 2023. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Indeed, indeed. And as we speak, in February 2025, your adaptation of Jill Hornby's Miss Austen is now available on the BBC iPlayer.
It is indeed. You can go there and watch all four episodes if you so desire.
Indeed. I have watched two. Me and my wife are saving two for later.
Okay, that's good.
And we will talk about your writing process with regard to Miss Austen if we can. And we will also talk about three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Does that sound like fun?
That sounds like a lot of fun. Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So before we get into process, do you want to give a sort of brief synopsis to what Miss Austen is about as a TV series?
Yeah. Basically, Miss Austen in question is not necessarily Jane Austen, it's Cassandra Austen. Mm-hmm. And Cassandra Austen, it was Jane Austen's elder sister. And she has a reputation among literary circles for being something of a cultural vandal, because she took it upon herself quite a long time after Jane died and just before her own death to burn the vast majority of Jane Austen's private correspondence. She left 161 letters, I think, for posterity. And there will have been thousands, because Jane was a prolific letter writer as well as a novelist.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of people are just like, why did she do that? How could she possibly take all that from us when we could have found out so much about Jane and Jane Austen's private life and all that? And that's exactly why she did it, we think.
Yeah.
I mean, Jill Hornby has fictionalized, obviously, and theoreticized the speculation behind Cassandra's possible motivation. But she does it with such aplomb and such... She's seeped in Jane Austen, Jill Hornby. She's done her research. She's read all the, you know, she's obviously worked from all the other letters. So she creates Jane's letters in her book. Mm. And you honestly read them and you think, oh my goodness, did Jane Austen actually write these? And of course she didn't, because Jane Austen, most of them got scorched by Cassandra. So I would say that it's an exploration of Cassandra's possible motivations as to why she might have taken this heinous act. And we come down, obviously, on the side of redeeming her. I think I can safely say that, because our premise at working from Jill's novel is that it was actually an act of love, that it was noble, because she didn't feel anyone had the right to know more than what is contained in the book. And it's in the Austen books. And I think it's very interesting in the light of today, when we all overshare like mad, you know, digitally. Mm. I think it's almost like Cassandra could see into the future. She was prescient about what private lives are subjected to all kinds of scrutiny nowadays. You know, I mean, so Do people actually have the right to know any more about an author than is contained in their work? It's kind of, that's the question that we pose. So that's what it's about.
When you're embarking on an adaptation of a book, what are the early parts of the process for you? Is it the same set approach for each adaptation, or does the source material dictate your approach?
Yeah, every adaptation is different, I think, because you have to, a lot of the time, I mean, what will be the same is the first time I read a book, or the second or the third or the fourth, because I reread it before I actually start thinking about how I'm going to tell it. And that, I think I do that to hope that the story and the way that the screen story should be structured or told will emerge for me. Mm-hmm. So lots of reading of the actual source material first. And I have to then try and work out whose story is this? Who is the central character? What is the actual essence of this story? Because adaptation, and a lot of people think this, and it drives me to distraction. They think that adaptation is just cutting and pasting. Mm. And you throw the book up into the air and it magically comes down and it just presents itself on the page. It's really not like that, as you well know yourself.
Yes, indeed.
You have to dig in among the book, and you have to pull the story out most often. I mean, if you're very lucky, you get a book that just is so cinematic that you go, oh, I'll just put it all. You do cut and paste it. But that is, in my experience, very rare. And Miss Austen presented a certain set of challenges because there's so many letters in it.
Yeah.
And letters are quite fundamentally non-dramatic, you know. Yeah. I mean, watching people read a letter or write a letter isn't necessarily the most riveting thing, even if it is Jane Austen. So the first thing we did, my development producer, Christine Langan, she's the executive producer on Miss Austen, and her company, Bonnie, actually are the producing company.
Okay.
I worked with her. So she commissioned me to write it back in 2020, I think.
Okay.
Because Jill's book had just been published and Christine got it in manuscript and gave me the manuscript to read. And then when I thought this is utterly fascinating. I thought the story was fascinating. I mean, I don't know about you, but I didn't know about the letters being burned. I had no idea, you know. And I'd read Austen when I was younger, obviously, but I was more of a Bronte's girl. You know, I liked all that, the bloke hammering on the window and all that gothic stuff. I really loved all that.
Right.
I mean, I admired Jane Austen because you couldn't not. But really, the gothic stuff was more up my street. So when I found out about Cassandra, I was like, this is absolutely fascinating. Mm. And Jill's book really does take you inside the world of Austen. And suddenly you really start to appreciate her for the I mean, she's a genius, Jane Austen. I can now look at it and go, my goodness. You know, some people will say, oh, she's a romantic novelist, as if that's a kind of to denigrate it.
Yeah.
And actually, she's the most brilliant social satirist. Her stuff, the stuff about society and the position of women and the patriarchy and all of that is so subversively laced in to all our novels. And I think you sort of, now when I've reread quite a few since I started working on this, and I'm completely overwhelmed by them. I think they're amazing. So I understand why she's endured now. I really, really do. So to get back to your actual question was how did we start? So we basically made a decision really early on that we would use the letters as a portal to the past,
mm-hmm.
and that we had to have two timelines because we needed to show Jane. And we also needed to show Cassandra's relationship with her sister in order for us to understand how much it meant to her to take her to the burning of the letters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was a very early decision. Two timelines. The letters as a portal to the past. So we couldn't, so that meant that in episode one, for example, I couldn't show Jane until the letters had been found.
Of course, yeah.
Otherwise my own convention would be out the window, which would have been not good. So we take a wee while to get to the letters. We take, you know, the first 15, 20 minutes, we're just in the present day timeline. By present day, I mean 1830. And then suddenly the letters are found and we're right back in, I suppose, that terrible word, flashback. I prefer to think of it as memory of of Jane and Cassie's youth and how, and so therefore we show their absolute total sibling bond and their total closeness. And basically it's a love story, yes, but it's a love story about two sisters and how much they love each other. Although there's romance in there as well, obviously, because it's Austen.
I mean, this might be this could be a general thing or specifically to that book. What do you think are the main storytelling challenges when turning prose into TV shows?
I think it's, well, for me, it's always about taking the internal and making it external.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think when you first read a book, your relationship as a reader to a book is very, very much an internalized one.
Yeah.
You read it and you run the film in your own head, your film. But when you are being asked to turn a book into a screen story, you've got to kind of grab hold of the essence of the book, keep an eye on all the preoccupations and the wonderful thematic stuff that the novelist has cleverly given you to digest and make it mean something in terms of a visual world. You've got to think about it being visual because that's what screen stories are. So you've got to think visually. So I think it's always about, for me, I always look at the in parts of the prose and I'll take a sentence maybe, and that sentence will give me two, maybe three scenes, just that one sentence, because I think, oh, there's a story contained in there, and it might be sort of hidden in the book, but there it is, kind of pulling it out. So a lot of the time you're like a detective. You're kind of going through the book and you're thinking, who's the main character? Whose story is it? What are the scenes that are absolutely essential to the telling of this? I mean, you couldn't do Jane Eyre without burning down the house, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so every novel has its own inherent essential event or essential scenes that contain the idea of the whole story. And so I always go through the book and think, right, what's essential here? And what can I afford to lose? What's necessary? If there's loads of characters, which there are in Austen, and they're all called Elizabeth, actually, which was another challenge. They've all got the same name. Can I amalgamate some of these characters, composite them and make three characters into one, and just make sure that they're doing exactly what the novelist intends, but actually making it more compressed for the screen story.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of books, you've got to think about how can you edit it down. And yet I always have to imagine the author reading my script for the first time and wanting to pull their hair out. What has she done to my beloved book? So I always try to keep their sort of point of view in my head as well.
Mm.
So I'll find the dominant point of view in the story, in the book, but I'll also think about the author's point of view and think, how would they feel when they read this? And so I'm not trying to please them. It's not that. Of course I am. But what I mean is I'm not slavish, I don't think. I don't think you can't afford to be slavish.
That's a segue for me then, because I wonder how do you manage that relationship between someone whose finished work is out there? I mean, something that a producer I'm working with, he asked me to do when we first started work on one of the books, he said to me, ask the author, what's the worst thing we could do to the book adapting it to screen? Just as a kind of find out what they're most scared of, you know. And it was really revelatory, because in the two instances I've had, it was don't tone this down, don't do this and don't do that. And the other one was, I don't care. So it's like, you can't.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, I preferred the first one. I don't care was like a bit too freeing.
Oh yeah, that's scary. That's like no rules, on you go.
You know,
you're just like, oh no, that's swimming without a life raft. No, yeah. No. Ugh, that makes me shudder. Every author, like every book, is different.
Okay.
So with Pandro Hagen, for example, on Mayflies,
mm-hmm.
he and I became incredibly close friends. And he was an executive producer, so he was invaluable in the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically said to me, you know, run anything by me that you're not sure of, and we can discuss it. And I would sometimes when I was thinking I needed a line of dialogue for something that maybe wasn't in the book, and I was thinking, what would he say? Because obviously Mayflies is partly autobiographical.
Indeed, yeah.
So it's like a fictionalized memoir. So I would send him off an email, and I'd say, I need this a line of dialogue now when he's lying on top of the car. And within 5 minutes, I'd get a line of dialogue back. Yeah, he was amazing. What would you have said if you'd had to give a lecture on the war poets? What would you say, Andrew? And
course,
I'd get a lecture
He'd
send me back a lecture on the war poets. So he was absolutely, he was my wingman a lot of the time, along with Claire Mundell, who produced it. We were like, we were this wee triumvirate. And he also said something really, really important to me, which was the women. This is a book about a male friendship, which it is. Mm-hmm. He said, so you feel free, to do what you want, do what you can to bring the women forward in the story. So, because he knew that the women are present in his book, but it's about the two boys, the two men.
Mm-hmm.
And my partner had just died at that time. And so I was grieving.
Right.
And Mayflies is obviously about grief.
Indeed.
And so I, with his absolute blessing, I took Anna's character and I imbued it with an awful lot of me. So there are scenes in the TV version that don't exist in the book. I mean, he talks about them, but I actually go to the hospital and see him having the chemo and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Whereas those scenes kind of came from my own direct experience of doing that with Simon, of going to the hospital and all of that. So I think Anna was a really fantastic cathartic thing for him. And for him to give me that freedom or his blessing in order to do with Anna what I did do. I mean, working obviously from his material, obviously,
because
you always do. He made that very, very, very special for me because it really helped me with my own grief.
Amazing.
That Mayflies was a fantastic experience, and I'll always be grateful to Claire and Andy for coming on that journey with me.
Well, going back to the Miss Austin, I love the melody in the dialogue that comes from the way people speak in 18th century or 19th century Britain. How do you tune yourself into that kind of way of talking? Because in many senses, the drama seems to come, and I think this speaks to what you were saying earlier about Jane Austen's, which is inherent in Jane Austen's work, which is the satire of what she's... It's almost like everything that's not said is what makes what's being said interesting.
Yeah. I think it was such... Society was so polite in those days. Subtext is everything. Subtext is obviously hugely critical in any screenplay that you write. The silences are often the most demonstrative things of all. But subtext in Austen is everything. And also the looks they give each other. And, the sort of unspoken longing when you've got a love affair that you can't quite consummate because of society or because of it being forbidden. So everything is pushed down, is kind of corseted, to use an Austen thing, and buttoned up. So actually, it's a real joy to have to do that. It's really good fun, to think they're going to say this, but what they really want to say is this. And I love that. Also, with a character like Jane, she could say those things. She could say out loud the things that most people don't because she's an acerbic wit herself, as you can see from her novels. Plus, I also had Jill's book, and her dialogue in the book is fantastic too. So I had a kind of, I already had a crib sheet, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I've quite a lot of it is my own, but a lot of it is also taken from her. So another skill is where you begin and the author ends. So you have to try and do it in their voice as well, so that it's seamless. You know, trying to find a seamless kind of marriage for you and the author is another challenge, I think, when you're writing. But hopefully in Austin, we've managed to do that. And also, Mary Austin was a fantastic character to write. I mean, because she's the villain, inverted commas.
Indeed, yes.
And she was great fun. And when, I remember when we did we had a read through before we started shooting. And because it was still COVID things in place, you know, we were still being very careful. We didn't want any of the actors to get ill because we were on a very tight schedule. Mm-hmm. And so we read it ourselves, the production, me and Aisling, the director, Christine, and Stella, who were producing it, and me. And I think Aisling's assistant, you know, she had an assistant on stage, on set, and she read a part as well. And I got to read Mary Austin. And as you know, I used to be an actor, so indeed, I'm still a frustrated turn. You know, once a turn, always a turn. And reading Mary Austin was just, I had a real ball doing that. It was great. And I was just thinking, Andrea, this is going to be a joy. For Jess to play, and Jessica Hines knocks it out of the park. She's so brilliant as Mary Austin.
She is. I love the way that she's got no qualms about. And I guess it's because we're informed by what we're learning from the letters about the difficult start Mary has in terms of establishing who she is.
The fact that
she's so hard faced later on is all the more dramatic because you know what Cassandra knows. It's like it makes it, you know, and she's blissfully unaware that people remember what she was really like.
And because she's a liar by nature, isn't she? Liar is strong. I mean, she embellishes. Mm. Mary likes an embellishment. You know, she likes to embellish the truth. Mm. I think for that reason, she is quite a delicious. I mean, she's obviously the same. She's in the book. Mm. And one of the things in the book that's so lovely about Mary Austin is that Jill does also give her vulnerability. So you get this really interesting character who's all resentful and bitter because the women, Jane and Cassandra, well, Jane is quite mean to her at times in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, she's a bit of a mean girl. And Mary's sort of isolated from their kind of sibling girliness. And I think that you can kind of understand where some of the bitterness
which is classic family dynamics, isn't it? If you marry into a family, everybody else's family's weird except your own, isn't it? It's like that kind of...
yeah, you know. That's true.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And I also think sisters is a very complicated dynamic. I mean, it's an amazing bond to have, a bond with your sister, but it can also be quite complicated as well. I'm sure it's the same for brothers. Mm. The whole thing was a joy to make. And Aisling Walsh is a genius director. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes when you find a director that just gets your work, you think, oh, I'm never going to actually, I'm going to chain her to my radiator and never let her leave my room or work with anyone else. Cause she is just, she really gets it. And she's an artist. So yeah, it was, I mean, I know I'm sounding like, you know, I'm glowing about it because I did have a fantastic time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, well, thank you very much for sharing that and giving us an insight into the process of Miss Austin. And now we will move on to three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Andrea, I have your three choices, of which we will get 5 minutes to talk about each one. And each time 5 minutes are up, we will hear this sound.
Okay.
You can hear that okay at your end?
Yeah, can hear it.
Brilliant. Okay, well, without further ado, let us look into something which is in the late 50s, young Ingmar learns a lot about life and himself when he is sent away from his sick mother to live with his aunt and uncle in a town full of eccentrics in what had become Kurt Vonnegut's and the actor Richard Harris's favourite film, My Life as a Dog from 1985, based on Rydar Jonsson's autobiographical novel of the same name. So tell me, Andrea, this is a film I don't know, so I'm learning from you now as much as everybody else. What is this film and why is it important and has memories for you?
Well, this is a classic coming-of-age film. It's Swedish. And I think it is one of the most beautiful films I have ever seen. And when I first thought about becoming a writer, I was an actor. I thought writers were magicians, and I didn't know how anyone could possibly write anything. Mm-hmm. And then in the sort of, it was the 90s, I suddenly started to think, oh, hang on a minute, maybe there's more to this than just being an actor. Maybe I could do something else. So I wrote a short film. And one of the things about My Life as a Dog was I watched My Life as a Dog around about then. And I remember thinking, if I ever, ever, ever become a writer, I want to write like that. Mm-hmm. I was so overwhelmed by the beauty and the poetry and also the total lack of sentimentality. I mean, it's about that, you know, basically there's a lot of darkness in it as well. It's about a boy, a young 12-year-old boy whose mother is dying, and he has to basically grow up over the course of the film. Obviously it's coming of age, but there is something so wonderfully, it's so moving. The way that he does voiceover, right? He tries to compare the tragedy of his own situation with things that are so much worse, like the dog that got sent into space, mm-hmm. and whose food ran out. And he says, you know, it could have been that. When you compare what I'm going through to that, I mean, it's hardly anything. And so he's got these lovely little voiceovers where he talks about things that are much, much worse than his own impending tragedy, because he's very, very close to his mother. And also he doesn't behave very well. He's not in any way a sort of soft-centered wee boy. There's a lot about adolescence and becoming pubescent and sexuality, you know, childhood sexuality is explored in it. And that is done so well because I think it's one of the most realistic explorations of what it's actually like to have one foot in the child's world and one foot in the adult world. I mean, it doesn't pull any punches, but at the same time it's beautiful and sensitive and sweet. And so after I watched that, I thought, oh yeah. And everybody up here in Scotland at the time, all the short films and all that, there was always a child at the center. People always wrote with children in their short film. There was always a child at the center. And so I was no different. I thought, right, I'm going to write a film, a short film with a child in the center, because I'd seen My Life as a Dog and it had completely inspired me because it is really beautiful. Please watch it. And so I wrote what was to become Dear Frankie.
Okay.
And so I like to think that Dear Frankie owes something to My Life as a Dog. So that is why I chose this particular film, because I feel like there's an umbilical cord. I'm not saying mine is as good, my goodness, no, because My Life as a Dog is a work of genius, in my view.
Yeah.
But I do feel there is a direct umbilical cord from there to Dear Frankie, because Dear Frankie's got a child at the center, and I like to think that that's not sentimental either. Yeah. And My Life as a Dog certainly is not. It's glorious, and it's very moving. Every time I watch it now, and I don't watch it that often, but I do sometimes think I'll just watch that just to keep myself buoyed up about writing, you know, because I think look at that, and I sort of watch it and I cry every single time.
Really?
And you know, I cry every single time, and not always at the same bit. There's you know, there's a few bits that just make me cry, and I just, yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how much I love it. And the acting is sublime. The wee boy has got the most expressive face.
Yeah.
And Hallström gives him a lot of close-ups, you know, so that's terrific too. There's a lot of close-ups. You're on his face a lot. His wee you just know what's going on behind his eyes, even though it's quite silent sometimes. It's glorious.
Okay, well, that was the sound of our first 5 minutes coming to a close. So well done.
Thank you.
And for our second choice, for those with any memory of 20th century movies, may well guess this one straight away. While protecting an Amish boy, sole witness in a brutal murder, and his mother, a detective, is forced to seek refuge within their community when his own life is threatened. It's Peter Weir's first film outside of his native Australia. Both Kelly McGillis and Harrison Ford, who are in this movie, Kelly went and lived with the Amish family and Harrison went and joined the Philadelphia PD as preparation for this. I'm talking about 1985's Witness. So tell us, Andrea, why has this had such an impact on you and what fond memories does it trigger?
It's another 80s film. I'm obviously regressing back to the 80s because that's where, that's where my film education really started. Since I was wee, I wanted to be an actor. And I was brought up with amazing musicals. My family watched a lot of black and white musicals and stuff like that. So okay. Judy Garland, Meet Me in St. Louis, all of those things. And then I went to university and I did drama. And part of my drama course was film studies. And I had an amazing teacher called John Corky, who would show us a film every week. And then we would analyze it until we were blue in the face. So that is where I learned about film and about structure and about how to analyze and read film iconography and all of that. And so he would break down these films. And when I saw Witness, so he gave me these tools that at that time, I couldn't watch a film without analyzing it. It drove everybody mad, you know, like frame by frame. And everybody was like, please don't do this to me. But I was full of it. Anyway, when I watched Witness, and I'd been grappling a little bit with becoming a writer because, you know, I wanted to, but I didn't know how to structure anything. I didn't want to read a book that told me how to do it in case I lost what I was doing instinctively. And then I watched Witness and I totally understood how to structure a film and how to structure a film script. I mean, I'm saying I totally understood. I still can't properly do it. Mm. But I kind of, in my bones, I thought, that's how you do it. And even down to something which people might find a little bit cringy is his name, John Burke. He does everything by the book. Mm. Harrison Ford is... I think it's one of his best performances. And I love Indiana Jones and I love Han Solo. But I think he really is magnificent in this film, as is Kelly McGillis. And the boy is beautiful. Mm. And then you watch how the film is the first act, how they explain the setup and how you're told, you know, the boy witnesses the bad men. Mm. And then Ford has to protect him. So he goes into fish out of water situation. So you're suddenly in the Amish in a culture clash. And then gradually, the romance or the forbidden love, if you like, starts to blossom. And it's so tender and so carefully done. And then you have the midpoint of the whole thing in the barn when they dance to the American music.
Mm.
And that is if you go by structure books, which I don't always, but I sort of understood it understood what people were getting at watching Witness. The emotional midpoint comes in that barn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The whole center midpoint of the film when they're dancing together. And then you have a wonderful set piece like the barn raising where there's no there's no dialogue, but you're swept up in the emotion of it all. And all the wee looks between Kelly McGillis and Harrison Ford. And then there's the love rival, who's also gorgeous. I mean, they're all gorgeous. And you sort of just go, this is terrific. And then, of course, you have the confrontation with the antagonists at the end. So, and he doesn't end it the way you kind of long for them to be together, but you don't get that. That's a spoiler, obviously, if you haven't seen it. But there's just something so kind of perfect about it in terms of screenwriting.
Yeah.
That's why I love it.
No, and it's interesting that you say that because I go and look at the trivia within IMDb for all the films when I'm getting ready for it to refresh my mind and stuff. And oh, there goes, I'll finish my thought.
There goes the whistle.
I'll finish my thought. And it is held, it says one of the trivia things about this film is the film script has been frequently used and often is there to display clear structure in a screenplay. I mean, I think It and Jaws are, and Star Wars, I think, are kind of like,
yeah,
they become like models. And it's interesting that studios weren't particularly keen in the film because of the rural setting. Thankfully, the word of mouth and the emotional side of the film reached people, and it got past that. But thank you.
I do think it is. I mean, obviously, that trivia is. I uphold that trivia 100% because for me, it is structured brilliantly.
Your final choice of your three, the lives of two struggling musicians who happen to be brothers change when they team up with a beautiful up-and-coming singer. It's the first time the brothers Jeff and Beau, Bridges that is, acted together in a film. And Michelle Pfeiffer sang all her own songs, practicing 10 hours a day in a studio to get ready. But also the brothers also learned to play the songs on the piano, so it appeared realistic. I'm talking about 1989's The Fabulous Baker Boys.
Oh, God, I love this film with my whole heart.
Oh, right.
That's... I really do. That is another 80s film, obviously.
Yes.
Because I'm stuck in that era. I just think this is, it makes me laugh and it also makes me cry.
Mm.
And there is something so absolutely perfect about the chemistry between the three of them, between the three actors. They just inhabit the world that is created on the screen so brilliantly. I mean, she's a marvel in it. I mean, she's so sexy. And that scene where she's on the piano in that red dress, you're agape. Your mouth is open watching it.
Took 6 hours to shoot that, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that must have been the best 6 hours ever spent on a TV, on a film set. And also, there's Jeff Bridges, who I would watch Jeff Bridges reading the phone book. Yeah. I would, absolutely, 100%. He is monumental. And actually, Beau is really fantastic in this as well. Mm. So the acting is great. I love the fact that it is a romantic comedy of sorts, but it's also got this underlying air of melancholy, which because of the, you know, there they are, you know, struggling musicians, not very glamorous situations. And there's something so beautifully rendered about their keeping their disappointments under a lid. And Jeff goes off down to a nightclub at night to dust off his dreams playing real piano, as opposed to what they do when they go out together to play to the captive audience, I suppose. And also they've got all the sibling relationship. You've got the fact that they both want different things out of life, but Jeff's character is just putting up with it because he loves his brother. And because he knows that is all that his brother really has. I mean, his garage with his wee, you know, he's got a garage with his wee mementos. I think he might have a bar in his, has he got a bar in his garage? I think he has. And he's got his wee cups and his wee mementos. And obviously all that, you know, it's funny when they do the audition sequence, when they're looking for their singer. I mean, that's really, really funny. And then Susie Diamond just sweeps in and sweeps them off their feet, you know. And Beau's character doesn't know how to cope with this addition to their triangle, because it disrupts. She's a disruptive influence. So you've got all this kind of conflict, but you've also got the romantic comedy of it, and you've also got this melancholia about how sometimes showbiz just doesn't really work out, you know. I love films about showbiz. I mean, I love them. I could watch showbiz films.
But I think in doing that, though, it's a bit like what Billy Wilder does in The Apartment, in the sense of the grim reality of life isn't far away from this, you know, picture book romance story that evolves. It's like when Susie Diamond says to Jeff Bridges, "At least my brother's not my pimp." That's brutal. That's not somebody trying to get you to love them. That's somebody trying to get you to wake up, which is a very, very harsh thing in sort of rom-com terms, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's why it's so. That's why I think it's so brilliant, because it's a rom-com, but it's got edge, and because of the melancholia and the conflict between the characters, all of the characters, you know, which you don't always get that in a rom. You get the will they won't they
yeah.
in rom-coms, which you get here. I mean, that great sequence when they both go into each other's hotel rooms and they're going through each other's stuff and they're looking at, oh, aftershave or, oh, perfume. And, you know, and does he accidentally spray it or something? And he's like, oh. So you've got that sort of, and then when they do eventually get together, you're kind of cheering, but at the same time, you also know, oh, it's not quite going to work out. You want it to desperately. Mm. And I love the last scene as well, when they come back into each other's lives and she's singing about carrots on her adverts, you know, and he actually really is sort of doing his own proper thing. So, yeah, there you go. That's my three films.
Fantastic. Thank you for sharing three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. They were wonderful stories. And interestingly, I think what you were saying before about the sibling stories within Miss Austin, I felt, you know, having the two fresh in your mind and getting ready for this, there's an element of what's going on in terms of exposing the weakness in the sibling relationships in The Fabulous Baker Boys, which is not a million miles away, really, because being in denial of what the relationship is and versus what you might want yourself.
Yeah,
I think it feels like a universal truth, doesn't it? It's like a trap that any siblings can get into, is that you end up getting so close, you end up appeasing them at the sacrifice of your own life.
Well, that is absolutely true. That's very true in Austin, obviously, in Our Miss Austin, because there is a point during the four episodes, but you've only seen two, but there's a point during, I think it might be in one of the later episodes, where Cassandra really does doubt whether or not she took the right decision, and not in burning the, not because she hasn't burnt the letters by this point, obviously, but in actually sacrificing her own life for Jane's.
Yeah.
And I think as she travels through, she comes to the conclusion that what she did was the right thing. So, but there is a kind of moment's doubt. The character actually does have that moment of, and you need that in every character, don't you? Where they suddenly go, wait a minute, what am I doing and why have I done it? And, oh, I've made a terrible mistake. So you've got all the regret and all that. And then you come through at the end to acceptance, I think, which is kind of classic screen journey, isn't it?
I forgot to say, and this is to muddy the water of your memory of Fabulous Baker Boys. In an alternative universe, when this film first went into development, Bill Murray and Chevy Chase were cast as the two leads.
Oh God, I don't think I would have chosen it today then if that had been the case.
And then it was Randy Quaid and Dennis Quaid, which again I don't think would. Madonna turned it down because she said it was too mushy. And then they went to Deborah Winger, Brooke Shields, Jodie Foster, and Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Wow.
So there's like this. Wow. It was weird reading them, because like there's they're whole different alternate universes of what this film is.
And yet, and those characters, those performances, those actors are that film, aren't they? I mean, they embody it. You couldn't imagine anyone else on top of that piano in that dress.
No.
Or even Jeff in the jazz club playing the piano. You couldn't imagine, you know. And he's so handsome, isn't he, with his floppy hair.
Is he ever?
Yeah.
Is he ever?
Floppy hair.
And Bo having to play the ugly bald in one sort of thing. And apparently he let Jeff shave the bald spots into his head because he wasn't really bald.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. Because doesn't he use...
The spray.
He sprays on it.
He keeps going, it's pain. He goes, no, it's hair polish. You're like...
I know. It really does make me laugh. I mean, I've never written a romantic comedy. I don't know how I would even do it. But that one really does make me... It gives me such a great amount of pleasure.
Brilliant. Well, look, Miss Austin is available on iPlayer as we speak in February 2025. And it just gives me to say, thank you very much for giving your time on the BritFlix podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.